The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
So, 2017 is the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, but it's also the 70th anniversary of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so we're sort of marking that 70th anniversary today. And I hope to just give you an overview of not only just the story of the finding of the scrolls and their significance, but also a little bit of an insight into what was actually found, particularly with reference to Christianity and our understanding of the New Testament, but more specifically, which will be unsurprising to many of you, in relationship to our understanding of the text of Scripture. And we have various pictures of the scrolls that will come up as I do. So it's a sort of a flyover history of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and with the odd drop down to look at some of the detail. Actually, before I start, I should say thank you to the Leon Levy Dead Sea Scrolls Digital Library. They gave me permission to use all the images that they have of the scrolls. And that's a good place to go to actually be able to see pretty much every scroll that has been found has been photographed digitally, and they've uploaded them onto the website, and you can zoom in and zoom out and see them. It's a fantastic site. Anyway, our history starts, however, in 2017. In our first slide, you'll see this is from the BBC, which is important to get in. And we have two archaeologists in the Judean desert. It was announced that they found cave 12. Up until now, there are 11 caves were found, the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the last cave, cave 11, was found back in 1956. So over 60 years after that, cave 12 was found. And here are two archaeologists sifting through the rubble from cave 12. There were no scrolls left in the cave. Absolutely no scrolls left. There were broken jars. There were the ties that would have held the scrolls together. And there are various other bits of archaeological interest, but no scrolls. The Bedouin had got there first, which is typical of the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Archaeologists come in on the back of Bedouin who have found the scrolls before them. And we'll see that in a little bit more detail. However, the next slide we'll show you was found in 1970. This is a charred scroll from a synagogue in En Gedi, and we'll see a map in a minute, which will show you where En Gedi is. This is from a synagogue that was burnt in 600 AD, completely destroyed in 600 AD, and the Ark of the synagogue, which is the place where they keep the Torah scrolls, contained charred remains of the scrolls. But you couldn't do anything with it. It's just a lump of charcoal. You touch it, it falls apart. But the Israeli Antiquities Authority didn't throw it away. They collected it and they preserved it. And we're thankful that they did. The next slide will show you what we can do now, because we have scanning technology. And so they've scanned, and you can't see it very clearly, but they've scanned that burnt, charred scroll. There was probably, we know from the paleography, about 300 AD. And then they flattened out the results of the scan. This is from the New York Times, this picture. And they found out that this charred, burned-out scroll is from the scroll of Leviticus. And you have portions of Leviticus chapter 1 and 2 there, which is remarkably similar, almost identical to the Leviticus that you would read if you opened up any Hebrew Bible today. It's part of the Masoretic text, which is the Hebrew text that we translate from for our Old Testament. And so these two examples both coming from the 70th anniversary, sort of introduce us to the idea of the scrolls. We're still finding out things, and we will still continue to find out things. But we need to go back. We need to just situate it geographically. So the next thing, we'll show you the map. So this is where we're talking about. Qumran is here. Okay, the top there. The En Gedi scroll. En Gedi is down here. That's where the En Gedi scroll was found. Jerusalem, you can see. And the Dead Sea. So the spot on that Google map is all those places where scrolls have been found, which come under the heading the Dead Sea Scrolls. The majority being from Qumran up here. Nahal Hever and Masada are down here in En Gedi, but they all come under the heading, the broad heading of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So let's go back to the beginning in 1947. And you'll see in the next slide we have Professor Eliezer Sukenik, who is an important person in this story. But before we get to him, how were the scrolls found? Well, in 1947, you had a goat's herd, Muhammad Ed Bin, who is shepherding his goats in the Qumran area. He's bored, and as all boys or young men do, when they're bored, they throw stones at things. And he started throwing stones into the cave opening and heard something break, which obviously aroused his interest, and made his way up there. And he found three scrolls. He collected those scrolls up, and being the shrewd goat's herd that he was, took them to an antiquities dealer who was known as Kando. And this is in March 1947. Kando eventually sold those three scrolls to the Syrian Orthodox Church in Jerusalem. And those three scrolls were the Isaiah scroll, a scroll called the Community Roll, and one called the Habakkuk Pesha, which was a scroll which had portions of Habakkuk with interpretation attached to it. The Isaiah scroll being the oldest biblical scroll by over 1,000 years, and it was identified very quickly as that. And it was found. In summer 1947, four more scrolls were found. Another Isaiah scroll, a scroll called the Hadayot, the Thanksgiving scroll, the War scroll, were three of those, and they were offered to and shown to Professor Sukenik, Eliezer Sukenik, who was an archaeologist at the Hebrew University. He immediately understood their significance and purchased them for the Hebrew University. The fourth scroll of those scrolls that were found found its way to Kando, that antiquities dealer. He's clearly in the know with the Bedouin at that time. And he then later sold that again to the Syrian Orthodox Church. Now, not long after that, the War of Independence. Israel declares itself a state, and the War of Independence starts. Now, that makes work difficult when there's a war zone. And during that time, the Syrian Orthodox Church showed their four scrolls to American School of Oriental Research, which at that time was headed up by a very well-known Professor William Albright. William Albright wasn't there at the time. It was a postdoc research fellow, I think, who understood significance, photographed them, and so all those original seven scrolls were seen. Sukenik, pictured here, immediately published his findings, as did the American School of Oriental Research, published very quickly. So it came to light very quickly what had been found and their significance of their find with photographs. So we have seven original scrolls were found 70 years ago. Four of those were in the hands of the Syrian Orthodox Church in Jerusalem and three in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Obviously, at this point, you have some excitement, and the archaeologists go and excavate the cave one, the one which is the stone was thrown into, where the scrolls were found, and they started publishing their findings from the archaeology of that cave. And they found the settlement of Qumran underneath the caves, and they immediately linked the two. Speeding up on the history, Bedouin, obviously it's worked out that this is a profitable enterprise, start searching the area. They find Cave 2 in 1952. Caves 3, 4, 5, and 6 are found afterwards. And in 1953, you have an international team of scholars who are set up to start unpacking all the details of these findings. There are no Israeli or Jewish scholars linked to that group, because it's starting to become a political affair as well. Frank Moore Cross Jr. was responsible, was the sort of most noted scholar, and he was responsible for the biblical manuscripts. And then in 1954, the advert appeared in the Wall Street Journal. This is an unusual advert. The four Dead Sea Scrolls, biblical manuscripts dating back at least 200 BC, are for sale. And now this is an understatement of the century. This would be an ideal gift to an educational or religious institution by an individual or group. Yes, you're not far wrong. That would be true. Now this is a Syrian Orthodox church trying to sell the four scrolls. But they don't want to sell to the Israelis. However, Sukenik's son, and he's pictured in the next picture, Yigal Yadin, is in America on a lecture tour, and he, with a certain degree of subterfuge, gets the funding and gets a banker to buy the scrolls for him, not letting on that he's buying them for an Israeli academic. He's actually buying them for the Hebrew University. And they buy the scrolls for a considerable sum of money. This is considered so significant that in 1955, on February the 13th, the Israel Prime Minister, Moshe Sharet at the time, announces it to the country that they have purchased the four scrolls. Then all seven scrolls originally found are in the hands of the Hebrew University in Israel Antiquities Authority. Soon after that, Cave 7, 8, 9, and 10 were discovered. Various excavations led to final examination of the site in 1956, and Cave 11, which we already referred to, has been discovered by Bedouin in 1956. One important scroll, the Temple Scroll, which I'm pretty sure that is the scroll that Yadin is reading here. It's a well-preserved sectarian text, Temple Scroll, was offered to Yigal Yadin at this period. I think he paid some sort of deposit of $10,000 and then was conned. So he didn't get hold of it. And so you have lots of scrolls have been found. Israel has seven of them. The other ones are in an antiquities museum on the Jordanian side of East Jerusalem. But not all of them are like this. The next slide will show you how the majority of them are found. They're very fragmentary. Now, I know you can't see the detail. We'll have pictures of in a lot of detail of the scrolls. And so you have the situation up until 1967. In 1965, Israel, the Israel Antiquities Authority build the Scroll of the Book, which is the museum in Jerusalem that holds the Dead Sea Scrolls. But they only have seven at that time. You then have the war in 1967, the Six-Day War, in which everything changes. Israel suddenly becomes in possession of the whole area. And all the scrolls that are housed in the Palestine Archaeology Museum in the Jordanian East Jerusalem are now in Israel's hands. And they take control of the scrolls and the museum. Yigal Yadin sent a troop of soldiers. He was in the army. He sent a troop of soldiers to the antiquities dealer's house. He had a tip-off, the one who had conned him, I think, out of $10,000. And after apparently some interrogation, they found out where the temple scroll was. It was under floorboards, rotting. And it was recovered, and that is also in the scroll of the book. The antiquities dealer was compensated later with $108,000. But Yadin himself published the temple scroll 10 years later in 1977. You think, why did it take so long? 10 years. 67, you get it in your hands. 10 years later, you publish. It's because of the amount of fragments you have of the scroll, and you have to understand what actually it is about. From that point on, from 1967 to 1990, you have academic politics playing out. You have a small group of scholars not publishing very much. The whole world knows you have this vast array of texts and biblical manuscripts that are 1,000 years older than any other manuscript that they have, and you have this very slow publishing of those texts. It's becoming an outrage within the academic community. One scholar described it as the academic scandal par excellence of the 20th century. Very slow production until 1990, when an academic, Professor Emmanuel Tov, took over the production team, and then suddenly the whole publication sped up. And by the beginning of about the year 2000, all of them have been published in their Discoveries in the Judean Desert series. Suddenly 60 scholars are involved, and the scandal ends. But one of the ways it ended was someone published the photographs and allowed everyone access to them. They said, these scrolls should not be subject to copyright. These scrolls should not be subject to one small group's control. And so it involved court cases, the photographs came out. The question is, let's go into detail now, how do they affect our understanding of the time period? So the next slide we talk about is the scrolls and Jewish sectarianism in the Second Temple period. We suddenly have texts from the time leading up to the time of Jesus and from the time of Jesus. And suddenly our understanding of that world, if not being changed dramatically, although it has changed dramatically, we were able to fill in that world with a lot more color. So this text here is called 4QMMT. MMT stands for Miksat Maasei HaTorah, a few matters of the works of the law. It is a letter, probably from the people in the Qumran community, possibly the Essenes, to someone in Jerusalem. And it says this one quote for it: "And for this reason, we have written to you a few of the Torah practices that we think serve you and your people well, since we have seen that there is shrewdness and Torah knowledge among you. Reflect on all this in his presence, so that you can rejoice in the end time, and it will surely be reckoned to you as righteousness if you do what is good and right before him." In this letter, you have three groups. You have the we group who are writing, you have the you group you are writing to, and you have the they group who no one likes. Traditional sectarianism. And this group is writing, saying, you need to observe Torah in its minutiae like this. It talks about whether you cook with copper or not, and issues of purity, and all sorts of laws. And they're saying, you should interpret the Torah like this. And if you do that, what does he say? It quotes Genesis 15:6. If you do the works of the law according to our interpretation, it will be accounted to you as righteousness. Abraham believed God and was accounted to righteousness. Here for them, you do the observe Torah like this, it will be counted to you as righteousness. Who the you group you're writing to is, whether it's the priests, and the they group, whether that's the Pharisees, or whether the you group is someone else, and they group, that scholars argue over. But it's a fascinating insight into the sectarianism of the time. They're dividing into groups based on their interpretation of Torah, and particularly their interpretation of the laws in the Torah. The next picture is of the community scroll. A very detailed description of how life in the community, possibly the Essene community, at Qumran actually worked. And this is a much clearer scroll, as you can see there. They modeled themselves on biblical Israel. They were priests, Levite, and Israelite divisions. They were divided into those groups. They were split into 12 tribes. Each tribe was split into thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. The ultimate authority lay with the priests. You see them trying to rebuild a faithful Torah community out in the desert. If there were 10 people sitting down to a meal, then a priest was required to say grace. Initiation to the community was very strict. You had to swear an oath to obey Torah according to the community's interpretation. You were instructed, and that was followed by an examination. Once you passed that first examination, you had a year's training in which you were not allowed to touch the pure food of the community. Once you passed that stage, you were allowed into another stage of purity, and then you had a second year examination, eventually being able to partake in their prayer meetings and of their bread and wine at their solemn meals. If you willfully infringed the Torah, you were permanently expelled. Lesser acts of disobedience had 2 years exclusion from the community. There are also allusions to imprisonment and even the death penalty. And the assumption is among many scholars that it is the Essenes, which we know of from Pliny and from Philo and from Josephus, who were the Essene community. And that is because they would link the community that's found with the caves where the scrolls are found. They said this is their library, this is their deposit, and they're maybe even the scrolls were put up there for safety in light of the coming Roman invasion. Some people still argue against that connection, but it seems the safest connection that the scrolls come from that community, and that community are the Essenes. The next slide is a picture of Tefillin. Remember, Jesus criticized the Pharisees who loved to make their phylacteries broad. Phylactery is a Greek word for tefillin. It's these things here that would be tied onto the forehead or the arm when they pray. These ones clearly weren't very broad. They are very small, as you can see. And inside those, you would have texts here. These are texts that would have been handwritten in the community's scriptorium, and they're placed in the tefillin, these things here, for when you pray, a bit like the scrolls you put in the mezuzah on the doorposts in a traditional Jewish household. And so here, just have a picture, when Jesus talks about making these things broad, I wonder what broad is. Those are very small. But it's an insight. It's a physical picture of the things that Jesus himself was talking about. Let's move on to the next slide. And we'll start talking about the Bible and the Torah, the scrolls and the Bible. Here we have a biblical scroll from Qumran. This is the first chapter of Genesis. Obviously, it's a little bit damaged up here. We have Elohim here, so it's missing Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim v'et ha'aretz. Now, the interesting thing about this Genesis text particularly is down here. God has seen the light, and it says God called the light. We haven't got the God called the light day. In the Masoretic text we have today, it says yom. Here it's yomam. So we have a biblical text from Genesis, which is slightly different in its wording to the Masoretic text that we have today. So instead of yom, it's yomam. Yomam probably means daylight rather than just day. So God calls the, rather than calling the light day and the night and the darkness night, in this text, it's Yomam. He calls the light daylight. Maybe avoiding the confusion between the uses of the word Yom there. Now, what does that do for us in relation to understanding of the biblical text? Text critics then have to decide. What do we do with that? When we publish a version of the Hebrew Bible, is it Yom or is it Yomam? It makes no difference to the meaning. But it is a different biblical text. The next text we'll show you on the screen is, if it's coming up, it should be coming up. There we go. This is 4Q Deuteronomy N. This is, we're going to zoom in a minute for the detail, but this is the early chapters of Deuteronomy 4 through 8. And we don't think it went beyond chapter 8. And so it's a text of Deuteronomy. And if you go to the close-up, which is the next slide, here you see, I mean, this is remarkable how clear these photographs are. This is a text that is over 2,000 years old. The question is it a biblical manuscript or not? Was it a liturgical manuscript? So this is the Ten Commandments. It starts here, Shmor et Yom HaShabbat, Deuteronomy 5. So these are all the Ten Commandments here, and then you have Shmor et Yom HaShabbat Lekadsho. So, keep the Sabbath day to sanctify it. Just as Kasher Tzivcha Adonai Elohei, just as the Lord your God commanded you, 6 days you shall work, and 7th you shall cease from all your work. This is the Deuteronomy text of the Ten Commandments. And it keeps going all the way down here. But then, and this is a surprise, we get to here. So that, the Sabbath commandment in Deuteronomy ends here. According to all the Lord your God has commanded you. And what does this say? Lishmor et Yom HaShabbat, Lekadsho, Ki Sheshet Yamim Asa Adonai. I know that. Most of you are going, shut up, stop talking Hebrew. And just tell it. That is the Exodus version of the Sabbath commandment. Because in Exodus, the reason for the Sabbath commandment is God created the heaven and the earth in the 6 days. And on the seventh, he rested. In Deuteronomy, the reason for the Sabbath commandment is the Exodus from Egypt. God has redeemed you from Egypt. And here you have a text that has, is from Deuteronomy, that has the Ten Commandments, but includes, after the Sabbath commandment, the Exodus text. Although Lishmor is not what we have in the Masoretic text, it's Zachor, which is to remember. So it's a slightly different version of the Exodus. Now that, and I'm starting to get a little bit of detail here, is a little bit more consistent with what eventually became the Samaritan Pentateuch. So the Samaritans, you all know about the Samaritans from the New Testament, they have their own Pentateuch, they have their own Torah. And it's full of sectarian detail. Trying to, so Mount Gerizim is the chosen mountain, not Mount Zion, all those sorts of things. But if you take out all the sectarian elements from it and compare it to the Masoretic text, it's slightly different in places. And this is one area. They have the root Shema, not Zachor. But the question is this a biblical text? It may just be a liturgical text. This may be a liturgical text. The Ten Commandments and Shema Yisrael, which is on Deuteronomy 4 to 6, were recited liturgically in the synagogues. This may be a liturgical text, not a biblical text. And at which point you ask the question, does it have value in understanding the history of the biblical text? Not necessarily. So as we uncover more detail about the biblical text, Not every text that has a biblical passage in is of equal value in the history of the text. We have to be careful not to step on wires, and we have to be careful about which texts we use. Next, let's look at the next slide, which the scrolls, the Bible, and the prophets. This is a beautiful text. This is actually from Nahal. The Cave of Horrors, Nahal Hever. It's called the Cave of Horrors. The reason it's called the Cave of Horrors is because they found 40 skeletons in there, probably connected to the Bar Kokhba revolt or and Masada and the Roman systematic destruction of anything in their way during the numerous revolts, either in 70 AD or 135 with the Bar Kokhba rebellion. But this is the minor prophet scroll, 12 prophet scroll, but this is in Greek. Now, those of you who have done a bit of Greek, notice all capitals and no gaps between words. Good luck. Yeah? That's how difficult, you know, it's and fragmentary. Yet beautifully preserved scroll. And this helped us understand the history of the Septuagint. Because this scroll was different. It had a different Greek text to the Septuagint Minor Prophets scroll. Septuagint was translated in the 2nd century BC, certainly the Torah, and after that, other books. And this is different. This text was closer to the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text that we translate from today for our Old Testament. And suddenly we started to realize that the Septuagint text, the Greek text of the Septuagint, that was translated from a Hebrew text. And that Hebrew text was different to the Masoretic text that we translate from today. Whereas this was clearly from the Masoretic text today, from the Masoretic text that we use today. In other words, what we find is that after the Septuagint is completed as a translation, there's sort of a reactionary movement, a translation movement, that wants to bring the Greek text closer in line with what is becoming the increasingly dominant Hebrew text in Israel. And so this is a revision of the Septuagint to bring it closer in line with the biblical text of the time. And so this is from what we call the Kaige recension, which is an unusual Greek translation, a construction, which is a literal translation of a Hebrew vagam. But again, beautifully preserved manuscript that helped us understand the textual tradition of the Bible. The next scroll we're going to go on to is the Assam scroll. This is 11Q Psalms. This is early 1st century AD. So this is Herodian. Now this is a psalm scroll from the time of Christ. Now the dating of these scrolls is done through radiocarbon dating, through paleography. They can tell from the handwriting and comparing it to other handwriting of periods of time when things are dated. Now this is of the second half of the Psalms, and if we go to the detail, which is the next slide, this is a close-up. Now there's a couple of things I want to point out here. Notice here this different script. This is Paleo-Hebrew. So this is an older script to this script here. This is the Aramaic square script. This is the older script, the Paleo-Hebrew. Now, why have a Paleo-Hebrew here? That's the name of God, Lord. Some people will pronounce it Yahweh, or we don't know how it's pronounced. Why did they write it in Paleo? Because even then, they're conscious of not pronouncing it incorrectly. Other biblical texts have just three yod, little letters there. There's clearly, even at this early stage in the history of the Jewish reading of the text, they do not pronounce the divine name. Which is quite a thought if you think when Jesus stood up in the synagogue. No, I can't say my own name. But he wouldn't have pronounced it. That seems to be a very old tradition. So that's the Tetragrammaton, it's called, written in Paleo. Now here, this is Psalm 133, many of you have sung. So Shir HaMaalot, Song of Ascents, of David, Le David. Hinei Ma Tovu Ma Naim, Shevet Achim Gam Yachad. How good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell together in unity. That's Psalm 133. Therefore, you would think that this psalm here is the end of Psalm 132, when actually it's not. It's the end of Psalm 141. And you find in 11Q Psalms A that in all the Psalms manuscripts, that the first three books of the Psalms are very stable and solid in terms of their order and which psalm comes after which. Whereas in the second book of the last two books of the Psalms, it feels like that order is still not being worked out, but there is variety in the order. But again, we have to be careful, because some of these Psalms manuscripts also contain non-biblical psalms. So the question is, are they biblical manuscripts, or are they liturgical manuscripts which are being used for in services of some description? Next slide is another thing of the Psalm scroll. This is Psalm 119. You can see, if you look down here, the same letter is used at the beginning. This is the pay letter. Psalm 119, Maranatha acrostic, 8 verses for each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. But notice the scribal techniques. He's made a mistake, so he puts it up there. He left out a word, so he puts it in there. You can see, but this one is also still using Paleo-Hebrew. But I also want to draw your attention here. Can you see the detail here? So it's animal skin. Obviously, it'd have to be a jolly big animal to get the whole Psalms on, wouldn't it? You know, that's tough. So they have to stitch it together. And you can see the scroll parts being stitched together here like this. So that's just a little bit of a insight into some scribal practices. It's unusual to see those sorts of things and how the things were stitched together. So that's a brief overview. Let me go back to 1896, and our next slide will show you how things have changed. This is Solomon Schechter, a renowned Cambridge scholar, sitting in the study in Cambridge after he has brought back all the texts and manuscripts from a synagogue in Cairo. It's called the Cairo Geniza manuscripts. Two British old ladies who were real old birds, real go-get'em, found a manuscript in Egypt in one of their trips, came back, showed it to Solomon Schechter, who immediately recognized it as important. He went to Egypt and discovered this Geniza, where they store old scrolls or old manuscripts of importance, and he realizes there's a whole wealth of material there, and he ships loads of it back to Cambridge, and here he is working with them. It wasn't good for him. Those are very dusty. And these aren't as old, but that transformed scholarship, and certainly on medieval Jewry and late antique Jewry and what they were finding there. But you can see what he's working with. Next slide shows you what it's like today. And this isn't overly modern. This is what working with Dead Sea Scrolls look like. You can see, under glass, just fragments. The painstaking skill and dedication of large numbers of people to take a fragment, fit it, you know, unroll it if it even rolls, and if it doesn't, then fitting the pieces together. Now, that should amaze us at the. And you look at the quantity, I mean, that's just a small fraction of what is going on. But also you need to realize it's both tremendously exciting to see it happen, but also you have to have a certain amount of care in the conclusions you draw. Now, what conclusions can you draw about a manuscript that looks like that? Sometimes we have to be careful. Now, I remember I wrote something in my dissertation about Dead Sea Scroll, and I'd gone on to I don't think it was this site. I'm not sure. It was one site such as this. I think it was the Gidon Levi site. And I got the manuscript up and I zoomed in so I could just see two letters. Because one letter, everyone was saying it's not sure what it is. And now I could zoom in and I thought, yeah, that's definitely that letter. I mean, that's beyond question now. So I wrote that in my dissertation. And one of the reviewers of the book, wrote some detailed points. And on this thing, he said, that is not without dispute anymore. You know, I said, it's clearly that letter now, all over. And he wrote, no, it's not. You know, there's still, you have to be careful. So, after 70 years, what has it done? It's under, the Dead Sea Scrolls have enhanced, have added tremendous color into our understanding of Judaism of that time and the time that Jesus lived. It's given us a lot of detail about the sectarianism that's going on there, both insight into how they understood Torah and how they understood how God works with Israel. Give us a lot of background into some of the things Jesus said, some of the things Paul has said, because they use similar terminology. It's given us a huge amount of information about the history of the biblical text. That information isn't always easy. It's not easy to digest. You have various textual traditions, all in Hebrew, which generate different streams of the text. So our understanding of the biblical text has increased dramatically. But it's also given us tremendous confidence in the Masoretic text. So we have Masoretic text types of the Old Testament that are found at Qumran that show remarkable consistency with a text that is 1,000 years later than itself. And so you have a tremendous consistency as well in a particular textual family. Okay, let's stop there and give opportunity for some questions. So we'll have some lights on now, see who's asleep.
New St. Andrew's College, thanks you for listening.